The business of the theatre, as of all art, has always been to entertain people. It is this business which gives theatre its special standing. It needs no further justification than fun, and the fun should be unrestrained. You might be surprised to learn that this is a quote from a German playwright and director, a practitioner of Hegelian dialectic, the so-called alienation effect, and other markedly unfun-sounding theories of theatre. Time to think again about Bertolt Brecht.
Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows 'em pearly white. Just a jackknife has McHeath, dear, and he keeps it well out of sight.
Bertolt Brecht was born in the medieval city of Augsburg in Bavaria in 1898. He wasn't just a playwright, a poet, a librettist, a screenwriter and a director. He also got his hands dirty helping to make the sets of his plays. And he was a performer too.
Und der Haifisch, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht. Und McHeath, der hat ein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht.
A performer, I said, not unlike our guest today, the playwright John Godber, hot from co-starring in his play April in Paris at the new Hull Truck Theatre. Hull's version of Brecht's Berliner Ensemble. And Brecht is John Godber's choice of great life. John, Brecht has clearly been an inspiration in your work. Why does he strike such a chord with you?
It's fascinating. I was kind of notioning on when I first came across his work, and I think I first came across the edges of the radar was at Bretton Hall College when I was training to be a teacher. I come from a very non-theatrical background. My father was a miner and my mother was a dinner lady. But I got this penchant for dialogue and this desire to express myself. And I went to see a production of I Am Brecht at Bretton. And I was struck by the fact that most of the people on stage had got placards around the neck which said, I am Brecht, and another one that said, I am not a communist. fairly simplistic. But that was my first kind of exposure to Brecht. And thereafter, I started to read about him. And I was fascinated mostly by his interest in the working man and sport. And since I'd come from a fairly sporty background, and since I'd come from a working-class background, Brecht seemed to be a theatre practitioner who I felt it was worth reading a little bit more about.
John Godber is the creative director of the Hull Truck Theatre Company. In fact, the job interrupted his PhD on German Expressionism, Brecht and all that. Academia went out of the window as he got to work on his first play at Hull Truck, a comedy about rugby called Up and Under. He's won innumerable awards, two BAFTAs a while ago, and even been described as Yorkshire's own contemporary Shakespeare, more performed in Britain than anyone except Akeborn and Shakespeare. There's been a Brechtian edge to much of his work, the hint of a left-wing maverick and an interest in working-class themes. You say, John, that you were from a working-class background yourself. Odd that you were impelled into theatre.
Yeah, I think theatre chooses you. Perhaps the scouts at Leeds United were to blame for that, and the fact that I didn't get on the Yorkshire First 15 at Plain Centre. But I'd got this real desire to communicate, and communicate with a certain kind of, if you like, non-theatre audience, and to, I suppose, articulate what had happened to me. What I'd been brought up on was kind of safe, middle-class, traditional British theatre, a theatre in a sealed world, if you like, fourth wall realism. And of course there's Shakespeare, and that breaks all that, we know about that. But for me it was the urgency of Brecht, and it was the notion of him getting out into the, you know, the workplace and communicating with, on the face of it, ordinary people that struck me. And certainly when I came here to Hull in 1984 to run a theatre which was insolvent at the time, though it wasn't mentioned at the interview. You know, I had an option. I could have either pursued the stuff I'd been doing with the guys at Leeds University at the Workshop Theatre, which would be, you know, Oscar Kokoschka plays or perhaps a remount of George Kaiser's From Morn Till Midnight. But I felt that the whole audience at that time perhaps wasn't ready for Murder, a Hope of Womankind, and perhaps a play about rugby league might go down more palatably. So I went on that route. But over time, what's happened is the more I work in the theatre, the more I find that Brecht had been there before me. And I find myself, you know, working with actors on a daily basis and talking about his work and talking about his poetry and talking about, in particular, the way that we present work. Not so much the alienation stuff, but of the making strange, but actually how we make the very mundane appear like art. And I think for me the best example would be my play Bouncers, which on the face of it is four guys stood outside a discotheque. But what they're actually saying is, look at how we behave. And I think there's a line, and I'm sure that we'll touch on this later, through from Bushner to Brecht to Peter Weiss to Stein and beyond that. And they've all been influences on my work. And fascinatingly, most commentators haven't picked up on the European influence in my work. And I wonder if it's because they're too funny. That the plays are funny, and consequently the politics gets slightly drowned.
I want to get back to that question of humour in just a moment. Joining us to explore Brecht's life is Emeritus Professor Michael Patterson, an expert on German theatre, whose most recent book is The Oxford Guide to Plays. If it's German and it's political, Michael, lots of people think, it must be boring. Isn't that the image?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's a heavy Teutonic playwright. There can't be fun. People find it hard to believe that Brecht was actually into fun. And this hasn't been reinforced by a number of productions in Britain. I recall seeing a desperately dismal production of the Threepenny Opera. And it's very hard to make the Threepenny Opera dismal. But it was done in underlit, everyone with white faces. It was quite gruesome. And to add insult to injury, the following Sunday, one of the critics said it was perhaps not quite gloomy enough for Brecht fans. Good old Brecht, he was anything but gloomy. He wanted to make the theatre entertain. And Brecht said, basically, the function of the actor in the so-called method Stanislavskian style is to hypnotise the audience. And he said, well, what's the point of that? What we want is the audience to be acquainted with reality, the reality of their own lives, yeah. Not induced in some sort of trance. And that then applies the whole structure of his plays, rather than having something that unwinds like a spring to an inevitable conclusion. He keeps saying, stop, just think about this. Couldn't things change? Couldn't the actors or the characters in this piece change direction? Does it have to be like this?
I think there's another thing, Mike, for me as well in that. We know that there is a world out there, and if theatre has anything to do with the world out there, and perhaps a very good current example is Enron on the West End, then it has to point a finger at the world out there.
I'm beginning to get the hang of this. So the play becomes a sort of spectacle in a way. Brecht himself once said that the closer the experience of going to the theatre is to a sporting spectacular, the better. What did he mean by this?
Well, what I take from it is the notion that, again, the breaking away of the seals, Aristotelian reality, that there is something bigger than the play at stake.
Brecht recognised when people went to a sporting event, they were involved, they were excited, they were absolutely rooting for their own team. I go to the theatre and people were sitting, as I say, in a semi-trance. He hated that. I mean, he hated anything that was bourgeois, and for him, that kind of theatre, the kind of theatre that John has described, you know, is bourgeois and deadening as far as Brecht was concerned. There's all this rubbish talked about how Brecht is unemotional. Not at all. He wanted emotion, but he wanted passion dedicated to seeing justice, to seeing fairness. And you get that in a sporting match.
Let's talk a bit about Bertolt Brecht, the man. His origins, Mike, what sort of family did he come from? What kind
of
upbringing?
Well, quite unlike John, he came from a very middle-class background. His father was a managing director of a paper mill. His mother was a deeply religious, good woman, from where Brecht probably learnt his familiarity with the Bible, and also possibly established the notion of the self-denying woman, which forms quite a pattern in his life. Like a lot of young Germans, enthusiastically welcomed the First World War, but soon realised what a slaughterhouse it was becoming. And in order to avoid conscription, quickly enrolled as a medical student, because he could be excused that way, and then did actually spend a while as medical orderly. But he never saw action in the way that many of his contemporaries had done.
At the same time as his authorship, he seemed very good at attracting people to work with him, gathering around himself a small team which he would lead. Someone once said that he collected people like mushrooms. It's quite a characteristic all through Brecht's life.
As you probably know, there is a book that has appeared by John Fuge, the American critic, purporting to say that actually most of Brecht's plays were written by his girlfriends. Well, this is a little of something of an overstatement, but I'm sure John would be the first to admit that people have fed into his thinking of plays, changed the way they've gone. It is a collaborative art, and people like Elizabeth Houtman, who knew English, incredible educated woman, and clearly gave most of the material for the Threepenny Opera to
One of his mistresses.
One of his mistresses, one of the many.
And then people like Kurt Weill, for instance, Lotte Lenya.
Yes, they obviously contributed totally to the success of the Threepenny Opera. I don't think they contributed to the writing, whereas Elizabeth Houtman has been asserted that about 80% of it was hers. But nevertheless, you know, like Shakespeare, these people are enlightened thieves who pick up ideas, themes, even whole speeches, and will then transform them into a play. And I don't think this lessens Brecht's stature to realise that he could draw on so many sources for help.
And John, it wasn't just a matter of theory with him that theatre was a collaborative effort. It wasn't just, in a sense, his Marxism. He just was as a man. He appears to have had huge magnetism. He appears to have inspired enormous loyalty in people to whom he sometimes behaved quite badly. I've looked at pictures of him. You know, the sexual chemistry doesn't come through the pictures. The command doesn't come through the pictures, and yet he had this command, which comes across in this clip of him rehearsing the Caucasian chalk circle with the Berliner Ensemble.
So weg auch, von sich halten, weg. Wenn's kaum geht, was dann, nicht? Ja, das ist es. Richtig, so. Jetzt weiß man nämlich noch nicht, jetzt weiß ich noch.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, John Godber, has chosen the playwright Bertolt Brecht, and our expert witness is Michael Patterson. Do you recognise, listening to him directing, the man whom you've always admired?
Yeah, I think that was a fantastic clip, because, you know, whilst my German is pretty ropey, there's real energy in it. There's a sense of fun in there, and there's also a sense of somebody absolutely absorbed in the rehearsal process.
He loved his actors. He was passionately excited by watching them and doing what they did. The only time he really lost his temper was when he recognised that people weren't making an effort. Then he got really angry and, you know, could freak out. But he was a director who was greatly loved by the actors because he gave so much to them.
He must have been, however, a pretty infuriating character. And he behaved pretty badly. The way he behaved towards women, three mistresses at a time. And apparently always wearing his long johns and his socks, I've heard.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain degree by which you do not cross the line with regard to heroes. And as far as I've been concerned, that's the part of Brecht that I've bleached out.
Rather not think about it. Do you think, Mike, that Brechtian theory was actually what motivated him from the start, and the plays are the result? Or do you think actually he was, in a sense, just rationalising what was in fact an instinctive approach to theatre direction?
I think rather the latter. I mean, he didn't really put down much about his theories until he was forced into exile. But yes, I mean, he was a person who worked in the theatre and then started to say, well, why is this working? Why do I want theatre to be like this? What is this thing, Verfremdung, which is badly translated as alienation, which actually just means making the familiar look strange. The great example he gave, which is very memorable, are a bunch of school kids on their way home, and they see the bailiffs going into the house of their bullying teacher. And the man is in tears as the family is being ejected from this house. And suddenly, the school kids see this teacher in a totally new light. That is Verfremdung. Alienation, more properly, distanciation or de-alienation. And that's all the theory is, you know, and it gets dressed up. Alienation can often be used to excuse utterly boring political pieces. Because, hooray, the audience hated it. We must have alienated them. Therefore, we were successful. Well, you know, I was tripe.
We've talked quite a bit about the fun and Brecht's own insistence that theatre was about fun or it was about nothing. But there's also quite a lot of anger and quite a lot of belief in Brecht's work. And you've said of your own work, John, you always feel anger, otherwise you wouldn't write. We mustn't gloss over that. Brecht had suffered quite a bit from malnutrition as a younger man, and he was a convinced Marxist. These things meant something to him, didn't they?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, he became a Marxist when he was working in the Piscator Collective, and Piscator wanted him to write about the Chicago Wheat Exchange. And it never got completed, but in his researches, what Brecht discovered was that apparently so-called, you know, hard capitalism, which dealt with the reality as opposed to these airy-fairy idealistic political ideas, in fact was complete nonsense. What are these people doing in the wheat exchange? They're actually buying futures. And he said, actually, capitalism isn't dealing with realities. It's dealing with complete fictions.
Yes.
And it was then that he started to study Marx and say, actually, Marx got a much better hold on what's really going on. He never joined the Communist Party. He was too cunning to do that. But it was when he saw police firing on workers and workers' demonstration that he then became a committed communist in all but card-carrying.
I want to come on to that in just a moment, but let's get him through the Second World War first. Nazism. Mm-hmm. How did he get on with Nazism?
Well, the morning after the Reichstag fire, when he saw that the Nazis were now going to be in total control, he got out of Germany. He escaped first to Denmark. Then, as the Germans pushed northwards into Scandinavia, fled to Sweden and then to Finland, and eventually decided the only safe place to go would be America.
His daughter with Helena Weigel, Barbara, recalls that time of coming to America.
I remember the pokey little house we had first in Santa Monica. We usually had trunks and trunks of manuscripts and books. We had to pack. I couldn't take my doll's house, for instance, because we had to pack all those damn manuscripts. And next to the living room, there were two rooms, which my mother knocked into one for my father's workroom. My father needed enormous places. He had a table for each of his projects, and he always had a couple of projects going at the same time. And he needed a lot of room to pace when he was thinking. You're not supposed to go in there. It was a big fight once, because he had a habit of, you know, after lunch or after any meal, to take a lie down. And I went in and tickled him once. That was a big fuss.
Hollywood and Brecht didn't really get on, did they, Mike?
No. I mean, he got to know one or two of the Jewish exiles in Hollywood, notably Fritz Lang, and did collaborate with him on one picture that got made, one that didn't. But Brecht's talents obviously did not suit the Hollywood machine at all well. And it was only fortunate that he became chummy with Charles Laughton and could get Charles Laughton to play the very first Galileo.
At Hollywood, his anti-Nazi stance cut very little ice. It certainly didn't with the House Committee on Un-American Activities in 1947. This is Senator Joe McCarthy getting going and all that, who subpoenaed him to appear before them. Brecht was one of the Hollywood 19 witnesses who originally refused to testify, but in the end, he decided to cooperate.
Are you now? Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party of any country?
Mr. Chairman, I have heard my colleagues, and they considered this question not as proper, but I am a guest in this country and do not want to enter in any legal arguments, so I will answer your question fully as well I can. I was not a member, or am not a member of any Communist Party.
Brecht, is it true that you have written a number of very revolutionary poems, plays, and other writings?
I have written a number of poems and songs and plays in the fight against Hitler, and of course they can be considered therefore as revolutionary.
Brecht wore overalls and smoked a cigar as he gave that evidence, having arranged this bit of stage business beforehand with his lawyer. Polite, cooperative and clever, he subtly made fools of the committee members and drew laughter from other observers, though they thanked him for testifying. "They treated me rather nicely," he said afterwards. "The Nazi committee wouldn't have let me smoke." The day after, Brecht was on a plane to Switzerland. His decision to testify was seen by some as a betrayal of his socialist principles, wasn't it, Mike?
I suppose, yes. He didn't want to get into trouble. Brecht was a great survivor. He'd come through an awful lot, and he wasn't now going to get caught up in some sort of witch hunt in Hollywood. So I have every sympathy that he wriggled his way around the questions and treated the committee with respect. Seemed a sensible thing at the time to do.
It said that he was a bit slow to find fault with Stalin.
This was felt by many to be the great betrayal, that here was the socialist playwright, a man who claimed to champion the cause of the workers. The workers were out on the streets, and they came to him in the Berlin Ensemble and said, "Aren't you going to join with us? At least, you know, write a proclamation on our behalf." And he refused. But if one's fair to the man, first, the German Democratic Republic was in its early days. I think he wanted communism to be given a chance in Germany, and he didn't want to sort of condemn it because they'd obviously made a mess of things at this particular junction. Also, he'd grown up at a time when people going out on the streets and confronting each other was very bad news and had led to Nazi thuggery. And I can see why, as a man of more advanced years, he wanted to keep his head below the parapet. He has been accused of cowardice, of betraying the socialist cause, and Günter Grass wrote a play, as I'm sure you know, called The Plebeians Rehearse the Uprising, which deals with this whole situation. But once again, I would give Brecht the benefit of the doubt. And he didn't act in a heroic way, but then, as he says in Galileo, terrible the land that needs heroes.
But he was, John, in the end, set up very comfortably indeed by the communist government of East Germany. They paid for him to set up the Berlin Ensemble, where his work really began to shine. What do you think about a playwright being, so to speak, installed by the state, becoming part of the state in the way that he allowed himself to do?
I've always believed that a writer, that a playwright, even if he, you know, is working in the subsidised theatre, really needs to reserve the right to bite the hand that feeds them. I think that is part and parcel of what being a writer is. And I think, in a way, I can understand why one might do this. If you've been, you know, literally all over the world, as Brecht had been, and hauled before all kinds of committees, and life under threat, and all existence under threat, that if at a certain time in your life somebody said, well, actually, you know, in order to make things very, very easier for you, comparatively, you know, we bless this upon you. I could understand that.
Temptation be huge.
Of course, absolutely.
Let us not imagine that he was the darling of the GDR. In fact, most of the Berlin Ensemble's productions were very heavily criticised, partly for their content, and partly, which was described as formalist, which was the catch-all phrase for anything that wasn't boringly realistic, partly because he ran counter to Stanislavski in acting tradition, and Stanislavski was, you know, the great Russian hero who was also taught in all East German drama schools. So, if far from being a popular figure in the Ulbricht government, on the contrary, he was an enfant terrible. And it was actually only after he'd been to Paris and London and they realised that they got an international success in their midst that they started to soften their attitude towards Brecht.
Nevertheless, his politics did give rise to a Brecht boycott in the 1950s, which was followed by a Brecht boom and then a period of so-called Brecht weariness. Are we, John, still in Brecht weariness? You plainly aren't, but is the Western world in Brecht weariness? Where are we now?
I've always believed, and I don't know if it's to do with how I came to Brecht or how I came to theatre, that demystification of what is art and what is dramatic art and who it's for is critical. And as we lurch towards an uncertain future, and as I identify the gaps between the haves and the have-nots in this country getting wider and wider, and I particularly feel very, very fired about education, that is, for me, the future. And that's where the real impulse for me about Brecht is drama in schools, igniting the imagination of young people in a way which, again, is about questioning where we live, how we live, and what we do. Because it's, you know, it's insufficient, in my view, to go and see a play or a work of art and to say, oh, yes, it was nice and we laughed and so on. There's a lot of so what theatre about. Actually saying, what kind of society do we want to live in? And for me, that's what Brecht brought to the questioning process. And I suppose you could say, well, actually, that's what Chekhov brought to the questioning process as well, and similarly Shakespeare. But what for me was a trigger with Brecht is he kind of shone it back onto the audience and said to them, make your mind up.
Brecht died of a heart attack quite young in 1958. He asked that a stiletto be placed in his heart, at least that's the story, and he wanted to be buried in a steel coffin so that worms could not invade his body. He'd written a will providing legacies for various mistresses, failed to witness it correctly, but his widow, Helene Weigel, honoured his wishes and gave the money to the women. He was dramatic even in death. John, you've made a case that I can't resist for Bertolt Brecht's originality, for his influence, for his talent. Is it on this that you rest your case for his great life, or do you, can you, admire the whole man, the whole life?
Personally, it's the work. I think everybody has the right to live their own personal lives however they feel and choose to do so, whether it be in the limelight or not. There are very, very lasting things I'd like to leave you with about Brecht. He said when his mother died that I wish I'd said I loved my mother every day. And the moment I read that, I'd said that I loved my mother every day, and I lost her 5 years ago. And if there's anything to take from a man's work, it's to do with the relationship you take from that and the people close to you. And I take that from Brecht.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to John Godber of the Hull Truck Theatre Company for championing Bertolt Brecht, and to our expert witness, Michael Patterson. Goodbye.